Blog Talk Radio.
Down the town, I'm the best around. I'm the middleweight champ at 163. You gotta be bad to hang with me. You gotta rock it with the doctor, like boots on top. I'm a doctor, do the boogaloo too. Ooh, pop, doo, bang a lang a doo. I got tons and tons of fun for you. Ooh, pop, shock, pop, got a shock, pop, got a rock, a mama good. Gotta rock around the clock, a mama dead, and pop, a rock, a bang, the boom, tang, tang, real good.
Planet Earth, third planet from the sun. Wow, I tell you what, it has been an interesting day today, being that it is Martin Luther King Jr.'s birthday. You know, whenever this time comes around where we start to celebrate Black History Month and especially King's birthday, I become reflective, and I start thinking about things like, well, I think about Christmas. I think about how my parents told me that there was a Santa Claus, and that he wore a red suit, and he was a jolly old man, and he brought presents and gifts to all the good little boys and girls. And I was also told that the Tooth Fairy would come in the middle of the night while I was sleeping. My tooth fell out and I had to put it under my pillow. And then when I woke up in the morning, there'd be a nice, shiny, silver dollar underneath my pillow. I was taught many things as a child that turned out not to be true. And a lot of it was, you know, for fun's sake, to inspire me to be a good boy just tradition, holiday tradition, Christmas tradition. And those turned out to be good things. I was rarely told anything that wasn't true by my parents that wasn't, you know, in that spirit. But there are a few other things that I was told that turned out not to be true. And it took years and years and years of developing as an adult. I was told that Elvis was quoted as saying, The only thing a nigga could do for him was shine his shoes and if you talk to any black person, anyone, just pick one. Pick a black person. If you're black, pick a black person. If you're white, doesn't matter. And ask them about Elvis. And 9 times out of 10, they'll quote that alleged statement. He never said that. No one's ever was ever present when he was alleged to have said it. There's nothing written down that he ever said. Bogey never said, "Play it again, Sam." James Cagney never said, "You dirty rat." But we hear things, we're told things, and a lot of times we accept what we're told at face value. Well, tonight I'm going to shatter some misconceptions about a hero to a great many, and even me. And his name is, or rather was, Martin Luther King Jr. And first, I'm going to highlight 4 things that you didn't know about Dr. Martin Luther King. First, his name wasn't Martin Luther. It was Michael. It was decided Martin Luther had a more prominent ring to it, so he went by that. He never legally changed his name. To this day, he lived and died as Michael King. We'll get more into that in detail a little bit later. 2, while working on his dissertation for his doctoral degree at Boston University, he heavily plagiarized from another author who had done research on a subject similar to King's. An academic committee later found that over half of King's work was plagiarized, yet would not revoke his doctrine. King was dead by the time, and the committee ruled that revoking the title would serve no purpose. It was also discovered that King's famous "I Have a Dream" speech was also not his own. He stole it from a sermon by Archibald Carey, a popular black preacher in the 50s. King was under FBI surveillance for several years, not until he died. Due to his ties with communist organizations throughout the country. King accepted money from the organizations to fund his movement. In return, King had to appoint communist leaders to run certain districts of his Southern Christian Leadership Conference, who then could project their communist ideas to larger audiences. A federal judge in the 60s ruled that the FBI files on King linked to communism to remain top secret until 2027. Senator Jesse Helms appealed to the Supreme Court in 1983 to release the files. So the current bill in the Senate to create the Martin Luther King federal holiday could be abolished. He was denied. Jesse Helms was not a nice man. 4, one of King's closest friends, Reverend Ralph Abernathy, wrote a book in 1989 in which he talked about King's obsession with white prostitutes. King would often use church donations to have drunken sex parties, where he would hire 2 or 3 white prostitutes, occasionally beating them brutally. I don't actually believe this one, but it apparently is true. There is a lot of validity to it. It's hard to believe, But apparently Abernathy was there, and this information comes directly from him. This has also been reported by the FBI agents who monitored King. At the time, King was married with four children. Today is Martin Luther King Day, a day when this country came to a screeching halt so we could have parades and memorials to honor this man. A man that most of the world views as a saint for his role in the civil rights movement. No other public holiday in the United States honors a single individual. Of all the great leaders in our nation's history, none of them have their own holiday. All of our great war heroes share Memorial Day. All of our great presidents share President's Day. Yet King, a man who was pretty much a phony, a cheater, a traitor, and a sexual degenerate, gets a day of his own. I have a big problem with that. Now, I'm not trying to take anything away from the movement, the civil rights movement itself, just Martin Luther King himself. I'm trying to point out that the vast majority of people are sorely mistaken about Michael King, and that reverse discrimination is blatantly obvious everywhere you look today. Have you been watching the news lately? When President Bush was president, he got into some hot water when he spoke out against the University of Michigan for giving black applicants presidents over more qualified white applicants. And then Jesse Jackson, the NAACP, and other black leaders were trashing him, without a doubt planning how they could use that against his reelection campaign at the time. It's interesting to me to discover these things as an adult, never having any thought that Martin Luther King, a man that I revered at the time as a young boy, I grew up during the movement, was such a flawed individual. Yes, it is true that we all have flaws, that we all come up short consistently in most cases, that no person is a saint and no man is perfect. But what I find difficult about today is that we are honoring a man who was terribly, terribly flawed, not just in the normal sense, where perhaps you steal a candy bar from the local store when you're a kid, or perhaps you have some personality traits that aren't necessarily attractive, or then you have minor character flaws, like most of us do. But we honor a man today who was deeply, deeply flawed in terms of character. And I have a hard time with that, because it doesn't matter to me whether the man is black or white or Hispanic or any other race. Obviously, I'm black. But Martin Luther King is revered as being a kind of a saint, the perfect man. And in the black community, you can't say anything wrong about him. When Ralph Abernathy made public Martin Luther King's sexual dalliances, his flaws, he was judged out of hand to be a senile old man at the end of his life. To be a bitter, senile old man, from what I recall watching the interviews at the time, he was judged to have been bitter because he stood in Michael King's shadow all of his life. This was the reasoning that was given for why he would come out with the information that I just read to you, a lot of it. Well, I think what troubles me is that as I grow older, I become so cynical because of things like this, where we find that almost nothing and no one is who we see who they're supposed to be, who we see them to be, who we thought they would be. No one. And it starts with, I guess it starts at a young age when we learn that there really was no Santa Claus. Now we grow older in our middle-aged years, and we discover, some of us discover a lot earlier, but we discover that the truths that we hold dear and the folks that we looked up to and idolized and revered were terribly, terribly flawed people. A lot of times we discover this in our own families with our fathers and mothers, sometimes often after they're already gone. But here we are today celebrating Martin Luther King Day for a man who did a lot of good. He sacrificed himself, there's no doubt. But did he sacrifice himself for black people everywhere, or was it his own ego? Did he see an opportunity to advance himself? And perhaps to him was the danger worth it, so that he could advance himself. Obviously, the man was flawed. The fact that he plagiarized more than half of his doctoral thesis is fact. The fact that he was known to sleep around on his wife was fact. And a lot of people will say that, well, that's not important. What is important is what he did for black people everywhere and what he did for the country and all of that. And I agree. I do. That's what's important. I'm talking about the loss of truth, the loss of innocence when we discover that a lot of truths that we have held dear most of our lives are false. They were never true. The truth. According to all accounts, the name Martin Luther King, the name on Martin Luther King's birth certificate is Michael. There's no evidence he changed it. He didn't pick the name Martin Luther out of the air, however. It was the name of his father used and claimed to have given his son. His father used that name. It wasn't even his father's name. According to Africana.com, Martin Luther King Sr. said that his son's given name was Martin Luther, but that the doctor who delivered him put Michael on the birth certificate, something he didn't know until much later. Until adulthood, Martin Luther King Jr. was known as ML, or Michael. Martin Luther King plagiarized in college, true. The staff at the Martin Luther King Jr. Papers Project discovered a lot of plagiarism in Martin Luther King's writings, and in 1991, a 1991 article in the Journal of American History said that plagiarism was a general pattern evident in nearly all of his academic writings, including his doctoral dissertation. Martin Luther King also, as I pointed out, plagiarized his I Have a Dream speech. Critics have charged that King plagiarized that too by borrowing from a speech given at the Republican convention in 1952 by an African American preacher named Archibald Carey Jr. Some say that he gave Carey's speech word for word. It can probably be said that King borrowed from the idea of the speech by Carey, who was a friend of King's, but only the last couple of paragraphs resembled Carey's speech, and little of it is word for word. Both men spun their remarks off the words of the song, "My Country, 'Tis of Thee." So, we've cleared that up. King's speech ended with, "This will be the day when all God's children will be able to sing with a new meaning, 'My country, 'tis of thee, sweet land of liberty, of thee I sing. Land where my fathers died, land of the pilgrim's pride, from every mountainside, let freedom ring. And if America is to be a great nation, this must become true. So let freedom ring from the prodigious hilltops of New Hampshire. Let freedom ring from the mighty mountains of New York. Let freedom ring from the heightening Alleghenies of Pennsylvania. Let freedom ring from the snow-capped Rockies of Colorado. Let freedom ring from the curvaceous peaks of California. But not only that, let freedom ring from Stone Mountain of Georgia. Let freedom ring from Lookout Mountain of Tennessee. Let freedom ring from every hill and every molehill of Mississippi, from every mountainside. Let freedom ring." When we let freedom ring, when we let it ring from every village and every hamlet, from every state and every city, we will be able to speed up that day when all God's children, black men and white men, Jews and Gentiles, Protestants and Catholics, will be able to join in hands and sing in the words of the old Negro spiritual, "Free at last, free at last. Thank God Almighty, we are free at last." A beautiful and very moving speech. Now, Carey's speech ended with, "We, Negro Americans, sing with the all loyal Americans, 'My country, 'tis of thee, sweet land of liberty, of thee I sing. Land where my fathers died, land of the pilgrim's pride, from every mountainside, let freedom ring.'" That's exactly what we mean. From every mountainside, let freedom ring. Not only from the great mountains and white mountains of Vermont and New Hampshire, not only from the Catskills of New York, but from the Ozarks in Arkansas, from the Stone Mountain in Georgia, from the Blue Ridge Mountains in Virginia, let it ring not only for the minorities of the United States, but for the disinherited of all the earth. May the Republican Party under God, from every mountainside, let freedom ring. And that was Carey's ending to his speech. Very similar. And we went over King's ties to the Communist Party. King was under surveillance because of his ties to communist organizations. David Garrell, the author of Bearing the Cross, a book about Martin Luther King, says that King's criticism of the Kennedy administration drew administration scrutiny. There was suspicion that two of his associates, including Stanley Livingston, had disassociated from the Communist Party as a cover to work with and influence King. Despite extensive surveillance, the FBI was never able to find any direct funding or other links between King and the Communist Party. All right. King had an obsession with bright prostitutes and used church funds for drunken parties. Well, one of King's closest associates addressed rumors about King's sexual activities in his 1989 book, and the walls came tumbling down. That was the Reverend Ralph Abernathy. He said that King did have a weakness for women and engaged in extramarital affairs. He denied reports that he was attracted to white women, and said he never knew of King to be involved with a white woman. As part of its surveillance activities, the FBI did document some sexual encounters involving Michael King, Martin Luther King. We've not found any substantiation about prostitute sex parties or church funds being used for such things. So, we've gotten those things clued up, and those are part of the four things that we discussed that I talked about initially. When I read about these things, once again, I have to say that for me, it's about more than the civil rights movement and ML King, and it's more about growing older and realizing that, as I previously stated, that, well, you begin to wonder what's real, what's true. And then you begin to wonder, does it really matter? Does it really matter that Martin Luther King was a womanizer? A lot of men are. Does it matter that he plagiarized his doctoral thesis and most of his writings? It happens. Do any of Martin Luther King's failings as a man matter in the overall big picture of the civil rights movement? No, I don't think so. I don't subscribe, well, not in most cases, that the ends justify the means, because clearly ML King, well, he didn't have sex with women who wasn't his wife for the sake of the civil rights movement. He did that because he was selfish and arrogant and thoughtless. I would say that he plagiarized his doctoral thesis for the same reason. I am sad. Really, really sad. Because every January, the media go into a kind of frenzy of adulation for Dr. King. And it's unnecessary. He did not single-handedly bring about integration or the civil rights movement. He was the spokesperson. There were so many other unsung heroes who should equally be honored for their participation. there are so many black men who were killed, murdered, as a result of their participation, their sacrifice for the civil rights movement in order to bring about change in America, positive change, not change you can believe in Barack Obama style, but positive change. Medgar Evers does not have a birthday celebrated in his honor. Does he? No, he does not. Edgar Nixon. Who is Edgar Nixon, you might ask? Well, he is actually the author, the architect of what was then the modern day civil rights movement. There's no day in his honor. None. He is the man who sent out 300 letters to clergy throughout the South, black clergy. All responded except one. Can you guess his name? His name was Martin Luther King. He said he wanted no part of the movement. He wanted no part of the leadership. It is admirable that he, in time, acquiesced and joined the movement and then became its face, its spokesman. But initially, he wanted no part of it. Edgar Daniel Nixon, born July 12, 1899, and died February 25, 1987. There's no honor. He is not being honored. When have you heard his name ever? Well, Nixon was born on July 12, 1899 in Montgomery. As a boy, Nixon received about 1 year of formal education. After working in a train station baggage room, he finally became a Pullman car porter. Years before the bus boycott, Nixon had started campaigning for voting rights and civil rights for African Americans in Montgomery. He served as an unelected advocate for the African American community, helping individuals deal with uncooperative white office holders, policemen, and civil servants in 1940. Nixon organized 750 African American men to march to the Montgomery County Courthouse and attempt to register to vote. In 1954, he ran for a seat on the County Democratic Executive Committee. The next year, he questioned the Democratic candidates to the Montgomery City Commission on their positions on civil rights issues. So here is a man who, well before Martin Luther King stepped to the forefront, was risking his life every single day to bring about change in America as it relates to race relations. There is no honor for him. Is there even a plaque? Does anyone besides me even know his name? In the early 1950s, Nixon and Joanne Robinson, president of the Women's Political Council, decided to mount a court challenge to the discriminatory seating practices on Montgomery municipal buses, along with a boycott of the bus company. This is in the early 50s. A Montgomery ordinance reserved the front seats on these buses for white passengers only, forcing African American riders to sit in the back. Before the activists could mount the court challenge, they needed someone to voluntarily break this bus seating law and be arrested for it. Nixon carefully searched for a suitable plaintiff. He rejected one candidate because he didn't believe she had the fortitude to see the case through. Nixon rejected a second candidate because she was an unwed mother, and a third candidate because her father was an alcoholic. The final choice was Rosa Parks, the elected secretary of the Montgomery NAACP. On December 1, 1955, Parks entered a Montgomery bus, refusing to give up her seat for a white passenger, and was then arrested. After being called about Parks' arrest, Nixon went to bail her out of jail. He arranged for Parks' friend, Clifford Durr, a sympathetic white lawyer, to represent her. After years working with Parks, Nixon was certain that she was the ideal candidate to challenge the discriminatory seating policy. Even so, Nixon had to persuade Parks to lead the fight. After consulting with her mother and husband, Parks accepted the challenge. So, once again, we find that things we were taught in grade school, things that are still being taught today, alleged facts, are not facts at all. As a young child, I was taught that this tired, middle-aged seamstress, her feet were hurting. She had worked a busy, tired, long, hot day as a seamstress. She got onto the bus in Montgomery and began the long, hot ride home, where she would have to depart the bus and walk several blocks to her house. Just another tired black woman trying to make a way in the world. And a white person gets on the bus and they ask her to give up her seat. They demand it. Well, she's just too tired. She refuses to give up her seat because she's just tired. And no more. No more. She wants justice. That wasn't the case at all. But that's what we were taught. Children everywhere were taught this. How courageous Rosa Parks was. Just a woman who was trying to get home after a long, hard day, who said, enough, enough. We all revered this woman, right? Up until the day she died, and even now, Rosa Parks is looked upon as a near saint. But it was all a lie. It was staged. The whole thing was staged. In fact, women, black women, weeks, days, months before Rosa Parks had done the very same thing, unscripted, not staged. We'll talk about it if we have time. They were quietly removed from the bus and arrested and let out on bail and went home. But Rosa Parks, the heroine, the hero, the brave soul who went against the white establishment to challenge why a white person deserved to have a seat on a bus after a black man, a black person is sitting there. Why should they give up their seat? It was all a lie, staged. And we believed it. Just like we believed in Santa Claus. So, after Parks' arrest, Nixon called a number of local ministers to organize support for the boycott. The third minister he called was a young minister who was newly arrived from Atlanta, Georgia, Michael King, or as you know him, Martin Luther King Jr. King said he would think about it and call back. He did not call back. Nixon was forced to call several times and even and get other preachers. Finally, King, with his back to the wall, called Nixon back. He told Nixon that he would participate in the boycott and that he had already arranged a meeting at his church. Well, Nixon couldn't attend because of an out-of-town business trip. He therefore took precautions to see that no one was elected to lead the boycott campaign until he returned. When Nixon returned to Montgomery, he met with Reverend Ralph David Abernathy and Reverend E.N. French to plan the program for the next boycott meeting. They came up with a list of demands for the bus company and named the new organization, the Montgomery Improvement Association, or MIA. They discussed candidates for president of the association. Nixon recommended King to Abernathy and French because Nixon believed that King had not been compromised by dealing with the local white power structure. Nixon now met with a larger group of ministers to plan the boycott. However, the meeting did not proceed as Nixon had envisioned. See, the ministers wanted to organize a low-key boycott that would not upset the white power structure in Montgomery. And this was completely opposite of what Nixon and other activists wanted to achieve. So an exasperated Nixon threatened to publicly denounce the ministers as cowards. And that spurned King to stand and state that he was no coward. By the end of the meeting, King had accepted the MIA presidency and Nixon had become the treasurer. That evening, King delivered the keynote address to the full meeting. What was expected to be a short boycott lasted 381 days. Despite fierce political opposition, police coercion, and physical threats, the boycott held. Bus ridership plummeted, and the bus company was on the verge of financial ruin. On February 1, 1956, a bomb exploded in front of Nixon's home. In the meantime, the court challenge worked its way through the court system until it reached the United States Supreme Court. The boycott finally ended following the Supreme Court decision holding that Montgomery's segregation policy was unlawful. Nixon later described the Montgomery bus boycott to an audience of supporters in New York's Madison Square Garden. I quote, "I'm from Montgomery, Alabama, a city that is known as the cradle of the Confederacy, that had stood still for more than 93 years until Rosa L. Parks was arrested and thrown in jail like a common criminal. 50,000 people rose up and caught hold to the cradle of the Confederacy and began to rock it till the Jim Crow rockers began to reveal and the segregated slates began to fall out." So, after the boycott, Nixon's relationship with the MIA was contentious. He frequently had sharp disagreements with others in the MIA, and he also expressed resentment that King and Abernathy had received most of the credit for the boycott as opposed to local activists, including himself, who had spent years struggling against racism. Nixon ultimately resigned his post as MIA treasurer with a bitter letter to King complaining that he had been treated as a child. Nixon continued to feud with Montgomery's black middle-class community for the next decade. However, by the late 1960s, a series of political defeats eliminated his leadership role in the MIA. After retiring from the railroad, Nixon worked as a recreation director of a public housing project. Edgar Nixon died at age 87 on February 25, 1987. He is very little known, one would have to admit. But Nixon, E. D. Nixon, Edgar Nixon, was the true father of the American Civil Rights Movement. Now you know the rest of the story. Couldn't help myself. Now, we talked about Rosa Parks, and we talked about those before her who had performed similar acts of civil disobedience and who received very little attention. But before Rosa Parks, there was Claudette Colvin. Who? Oh, yeah. Few people know the story of Claudette. When she was 15, she refused to move to the back of the bus and give up her seat to a white person. 9 months before Rosa Parks did the very same thing. Most people know about Parks and the Montgomery, Alabama bus boycott that began in 1955, but few know that there were a number of women who refused to give up their seats on the same bus system. Most of the women were quietly fined, and no one heard much more, as I stated previously, earlier. Colvin, however, was the first to really challenge the law. Now, at 71 years old, Colvin lives in the Bronx. She remembers taking the bus home from high school on March 1955, as clear as if it were yesterday. The bus driver ordered her to get up, and she refused, saying she paid for her fare and it was her constitutional right. Two police officers put her in handcuffs and arrested her. Her school books went flying off her lap. "All I remember," she said, "is that I was not going to walk off the bus voluntarily. It was Negro History Month, and her segregated school, they had been studying black leaders like Harriet Tubman, the runaway slave who led more than 70 slaves to freedom through the network of safe houses known as the Underground Railroad. They were also studying about Sojourner Truth, a former slave who became an abolitionist and women's rights advocate. And the class had been talking about the injustices they were experiencing daily under the Jim Crow segregation laws, like not being able to eat at a lunch counter. We couldn't try on clothes, Colvin said. They had to take a brown paper bag and draw a diagram of your foot and take it to the store. Can you imagine all of that in my mind? My head was just too full of black history, you know, the oppression that we went through. It felt like Sojourner Truth was on one side pushing me down, and Harriet Tubman was on the other side of me pushing me down. I couldn't get up. Colvin also remembers the moment the jail door closed. It was just like a Western movie, she says. And then I got scared, and panic came over me, and I started crying. And then I started saying the Lord's Prayer. Now, Her story is the subject of a book, Claudette Colvin, Twice Toward Justice. Author Phil Howe says that despite a few articles about her in the Birmingham Press and in USA Today, the brief mentions in some books and the civil rights movement, most people don't know about the role Colvin played in the bus boycott. He also believes Colvin is important because she challenged the law in court. One of four women plaintiffs in Browder versus Gale, the court case that successfully overturned bus segregation laws in Montgomery and Alabama. Now, there are many reasons why Claudette Colvin has been pretty much forgotten. For one, she hardly ever told her story when she moved to New York City. In her new community, hardly anyone was talking about integration. Instead, most were talking about black enterprise, black power, and Malcolm X. But when asked why she is little known and why everyone thinks of only Rosa Parks, Colvin said, "The NAACP and all the other black organizations felt Parks would be a good icon because she was an adult. They didn't think teenagers would be reliable." She also says Parks had the right hair and the right look. Her skin texture was the kind that people associate with middle class, said Colvin. She fit that profile. After Colvin's arrest, she found herself shunned by parts of her community. She experienced various difficulties and became pregnant. Civil rights leaders felt she was an inappropriate symbol for a test case. And then Parks was a secretary of the NAACP. She was well known and respected. Once again, we find that things we were taught to believe in just weren't true. They simply were not true. And it's sad, really. It's worse than finding out that the Tooth Fairy doesn't exist or Santa Claus didn't exist, but that the civil rights movement and the icons that we came to idolize were frauds and phonies and severely flawed individuals. And I, for one, feel conned. I feel like I've been played for a chump by Martin Luther King, Abernathy, and certainly Sharpton and that other idiot, what's his name? Jesse Jackson. I feel conned by all of these people when I think that dark-skinned, young, single, teenage mother, Claudette Colvin, who refused to give up her seat, was virtually ignored. Weeks later, light skin, high yellow, good hair, NAACP worker, not seamstress, NAACP worker, staged. One of the most dramatic events in American history. It was all a lie. And as I said earlier, some will argue that it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. The ends justify the means. All that matters, some will say, is that we received freedom, that we received justice. The ends justify the means, even though I, as a young boy, you, we were all lied to. Which brings me back to the original point of this program. What is real? What is true? Am I to grow old knowing that most of what I've been told and led to believe was never really real? That Rosa Parks was never the courageous heroine that she was made out to be? That Martin Luther King was a plagiarist of biblical proportions, a liar, a cheat? And damn it, Santa Claus was not real. What the hell is that all about? What else am I going to discover while I'm alive on this fruited plane that is not true? Claudette Colvin, I'm looking at a picture of her right now. Dark skin as a young girl. Glasses. Not unattractive, but still, apparently she had a pretty foul mouth. And she was only 15, and she just didn't fit the profile. So they picked somebody. A secretary working at the local NAACP office. I have a book right here. The Rosa Parks story does not mention that at the time of her arrest that she was working for the local NAACP office as a secretary. It only mentions the fact that she was a seamstress. The book doesn't mention that or make note of the fact that the whole event was staged. That her bail was going to be posted shortly after the arrest. That TV cameras would meet the bus. Ever wonder why all those pictures were taken? She was being removed from the bus. And that a lawyer had already been set up to represent her. I find it all to be so amusing. What else? What more are we going to find about our leaders that are going to be astonishing? What more are we going to discover in the coming years? Simply won't be true. Well, in honor of plagiarizing, womanizing, lying, conniving, deeply flawed Martin Luther King, I wish you a happy birthday. Martin, I hold you in no high regard. You are a deeply flawed man, and the only reason why I honor you today is so that I have the day off so I can watch the closer marathon. Happy birthday, Martin. Thank you.
Or in peace, the heart will sing. Thanks to Martin Luther King. Happy.